Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I am joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, Matthew, we are rating Scorsese's latest, Killers of the Flower Moon, Horror It Lives Inside, Le Carré documentary, The Pigeon Tunnel, and half-term Pleasure Pain, depending on your sort of pleasure pain threshold of trolls. It's Trolls Band Together. My threshold's very, very low for that, but we'll see how we go.
Covering the spectrum this week, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. So before we get on to those, though, what else have you been watching this week, Matthew? I mean, LFF's now finally come to a close. We're all knackered. Yeah, we need some sleep. What have you been seeing?
Well, one film I've seen that's actually is coming out this Monday on digital is the documentary Rock Hudson, All That Heaven Allowed. It's obviously a play on one of his most famous hits. So this is all about the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s star who famously was the first major star to reveal that he had an AIDS diagnosis. And that's a big chunk of the film, but it also kind of charts his journey through the studio system and how privately he was living as a gay man in private, but in public, he had cultivated this very kind of straight beefcake hunk image. So it explores the contrast between those two things. And there's an absolute ton of footage of like they've chosen every single movie clip they can find that has a kind of a double meaning or a subtext. It's very sort of cleverly done. And lots and lots of talking heads and voiceover as well. So it's a very well put together documentary. It's incredibly candid. So there's lots of interviews with his former lovers, which go into detail, I'll say.
You mean saucy detail?
It is quite saucy, yeah. It's very, yeah, it's very candid, very moving as well when it does get to when we find out what happened at the end of his life as well. I mean, obviously, I was very young when it happened, but I remember it being such a huge story in the papers without really knowing who Rock Hudson was or really understanding the context. But it kind of unpacks all that. So, yeah, it's just a decent portrait.
I will be watching it, definitely. It sounds great. I love him. I love Pillow Talk. That's one of my favourite films when I was a kid. Yeah. And as you say, an absolute sort of, you know, presented himself as a very heterosexual, dishy man who that possibly Doris Day would have liked to marry in real life. And then when this news came out that not only was he actually gay and sort of living this other life that he had not been felt able to show the world, but that also that AIDS was indiscriminatory, you know, that people were thinking, oh, you know, it doesn't really affect me. But then when somebody they really knew suddenly got it, it became such a huge thing. Similarly with sort of Freddie Mercury as well. I think it would be a very interesting doc. I will definitely be watching it. I went to the theatre last night. That's what I've been doing. I went to see Lioness, the new play. Well, it basically reunites Mrs. Danvers and the second Mrs. De Winter from Ben Wheatley's Rebecca. Kristen Scott Thomas and Lily James in a play that is about exploring Me Too and the fact that victims have to wait for their sort of aggressors to die often before they can get any sort of release. They don't feel they can escape what's happened to them and sort of the idea of being believed and worrying about that. So it's really interesting, very, very timely. It was the first night though, so I think it was a little bit needed to be tightened up a little bit, sort of finessed. But, you know, I just love watching actors like that go at it on the stage right in front of you. It's quite the treat when you see it like that. So I want to do more theatre.
Is it a two-hander?
It's basically those two and a husband that wanders in periodically. And is it Dune McKay from Drop the Dead Donkey?
Smack the Pony.
Smack the Pony, that's it. Yeah. It's very much our world because it's all about getting the rights to a story and putting a film into treatment and getting it in development. And then once you've done that and you've signed your rights away, how much of your story do you have any control over when a film company runs with it and decides to put a different director on than you had in mind and all of this sort of thing. So it's really sort of our world that we operate in and I very much enjoyed it. So that's that. Obviously at LFF, that's now over. Favourite films, probably The Bike Riders and Killers of the Flower Moon. Any favourites from you? We obviously went to see Scorsese, didn't we, together? The whole team went out to see Scorsese talk to Edgar Wright.
the entire film journalism world of London was there, descended upon the Royal Festival Hall. Yeah, so that was a pretty special moment, wasn't it? To see Marty letting rip on stage for a good hour or so. Yeah, talking through, well, a lot of his career. I mean, he didn't get
couldn't
through
get through all of it in that time. No way. Yeah.
Bit of an impossible task, but yeah, he was obviously very insightful and funny and incredible recall of details from 50 years ago and movies spanning the entire history of cinema.
And such a cinephile himself.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, yeah, he outshines everyone, doesn't he? I mean,
yeah, ridiculous. He's incredible. So that's a good segue, Matthew. We should get on to our next film, which is, it's this 3-hour epic. Is it worth every minute? Let's see.
Why did you come here?
I work for my uncle.
You scared of him?
Oh, he's the nicest man in the world.
The Osage, their time is over. We got to take back control of our home.
I was sent down from Washington, D.C. to see about these murders.
We have so many deaths, we've lost count.
It's just bad luck.
Seems more like an epidemic than bad luck to me.
Osage is dying by the enemy. Do not let them die alone.
Evil surrounds my heart.
So this is The Killers of the Flower Moon. I saw this a long time ago and it blew my socks off. For those of us who don't know what this is about, it's a true story. What's happening in this and how does Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro figure in it?
Yeah, so it's based on the journalist David Grand's book, which was the full title of which is Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. So it's quite interesting that they've kind of lopped off part of that title, because while the FBI are involved in the film, it's very much about the Osage murders. It kind of focuses mostly on that. And even though it's a very big ensemble cast, it's basically boils down to a three-hander. So you've got Lily Gladstone as Molly, who's part of the Osage Nation, which has become incredibly rich through the oil that's been found on their land. And then Leonardo DiCaprio plays her husband, Ernest, who's essentially a part of one of these white men who descend on the Osage Nation looking to profit from the money that the Osage people are making from the oil. He marries her, and in the background all the time is his uncle, played by Robert De Niro, who's William Hale, nicknamed King, who's very much a kind of a puppet master. He kind of acts as this kind of a benevolent community leader, but all the while he's pulling strings, and he's responsible for these killings that are happening. And then eventually we do get to the FBI come in to investigate these murders. And that's when everything kind of comes to a head, when all the chickens come home to roost over the course of this incredibly long 2.5-hour epic.
Yeah, it's a long one, but it is fascinating. I mean, it's interesting, obviously, that DiCaprio and Scorsese really wanted to make this film, this adaptation, this book, and sort of weren't happy with the angle of it, which was more the idea of the FBI and the fact that because they came to investigate this, it really made a need for such an organization. And it was something that consolidated them and created this FBI Bureau of Investigation. And originally DiCaprio was going to play the FBI agent that comes to investigate, but that then they decided to tip it entirely to the marriage between Ernest and Lily. And then DiCaprio said, I want to play that role instead. And it's an interesting role for him to play, because he's by no means the hero in this. He's a sort of sniveling, cowardly, horrible man, predatory, weak, not an attractive role at all for him. So it's quite an interesting role for him. And that the role that he vacated was taken by Jesse Plemons, who arrives in like the third reel. But the star of this for me, even though we're seeing DiCaprio and De Niro back on screen again after many moons, is Lily Gladstone. This film was made with such reverence and such cooperation with the Osage people. It's key that they are represented, and she does this wonderful job of really representing an entire sort of group of people that were decimated, and the heartbreak and the pain and the fury that they experienced. I just think it's worth seeing this film. You know, Scorsese is great. The score is great. The cinematography is great. Everything's great. But see this film for Lily Gladstone. She is tremendous in this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's nailed on to get an Oscar nomination. Any bet you're preparing to make, I'd say put your money on her, because I'm sure next year will be her year. Absolutely. Yeah, like you say, she's absolutely the heart of the film. And the relationship, it's interesting how complicated it gets between her and the DiCaprio character, because obviously he starts from a very mercenary place, but then you do get this affection that grows between them. But all the while, he's doing these despicable things, being manipulated by his uncle into doing these awful things. So you get that contrast, and you're kind of waiting for it all to come to a head. And when it does, it's quite devastating in the final stages of the movie. I mean, there's quite a few charming scenes between her and DiCaprio, like when they first meet, their kind of flirtations that they have as they kind of grow together and build a family together. But yeah, all the while there's this darkness kind of creeping in the background. I thought De Niro was terrific as well.
Yeah, I mean, loved him.
An absolute monster, but in a very sort of subtle, underplayed way. I mean, he's so insidious what he's doing all the time. I mean, right up until the end as well, he's still kind of trying to manipulate and gain advantage the whole time. So I mean, it's quite a sickening character.
Yeah, and also, while it does show the predatory, hideous actions of these men coming in, the patriarchal white men coming in to take what they think they should have, and it shouldn't have been given to, you know, the First Nations that were on the land that this oil was discovered on, you get this really good sense of this community and the sort of rituals and the culture and the rich sort of family history that these people have. And I love that. And the fact that that's being eroded as well. Everything about their entire life is being just eroded by this sort of manifest destiny. And then this idea that, why have they got this money? And this idea as well that they were given the money, but only on certain provisions. So yeah, they had to have a white sponsor who would let them spend their money. Just crazy stuff. And you think, this is this isn't that long ago that this happened. No. We think about the, you know, the horrors that were visited upon, you know, Indigenous people in America. We sort of think of it as, you know, sort of Wounded Knee and things like that. But this is when, you know, the Model T Ford is coming in, and this is within the century that we sort of began last century. So it's incredible to think this was happening, and on such scale that nobody was saying this is wrong until somebody managed to get to Washington, and then Washington thought, wait a minute. The industry that this was created on, the sort of wholesale industry of murder that was happening here, is astonishing and horrifying. I mean, I love it because it's that thing of, it's a real story, and we can go off and now dig into that and find out more about it, and it's amazing. As it stands as a film, it's an incredible film, beautifully put together, wonderfully acted, wonderfully lensed. But also, it's something that I think you'll have a really good conversation with each other when you come out of the cinema about. Yeah, yeah. Our own white privilege, our own ideas about things, and who owns land. Anything you want to talk about, you can find in this film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much to unpack here. I mean, the fact that the FBI do come in and assist, but the Osage people had to pay them as well to get them to do something, to get them to come and see what was going on and finally get the wheels in motion. So, yeah, all the time they're kind of on the back foot, or being, you know, exploited and manipulated. It's an American tragedy.
On a sort of massive scale. And, you know, there's this refrain at the very beginning where King gives Ernest this book, which is the history of the Osage people. And he reads it out, and it's all, can you see the wolves in this picture? That is what Scorsese is asking throughout this film. Who are the wolves in this picture? And as an audience, who are the wolves that are currently reacting in the similar way in our society? So I just think it's an important film, but also just a cracking one. And let's talk about it in terms of Scorsese's output. Where do you think it sits in his canon?
Tricky, isn't it? Because he's made so many great films that we've kind of lived with for so long. I mean, going back to the 70s and the 80s, I mean, he's been so incredibly consistent. I'd need to watch it again, but yeah, I think it's kind of high up there. I liked it more than The Irishman.
I did too.
Yeah, I did kind of struggle with that a bit in terms of not finding the characters particularly sympathetic the longer it went on, even though it's a very fascinating portrait of that world. But yeah, this feels like a very sort of the work of a really mature filmmaker kind of branching out and really trying to understand what has happened here and getting really into the kind of granular detail, not sort of simplifying things or reducing it to black and white, but really kind of understanding and painting a portrait. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a late career masterpiece.
Yeah, it really is. And also it's like that, it's that thing that if you really like the verve and the energy, amazing specific filmmaking of Mean Streets or Taxi Driver or, you know, Alice Doesn't Live Here or any of his great films, you totally see that in here. But also what you see is the combination of what he brought to Silence, which was his huge passion project, and the sort of stillness and the beauty of that, and the questioning of what we do to each other as people in the name of whatever belief it is that we're sort of taking away. So I think it really feels to me like it really merges all of his interests and influences in one film. I hope he's going to make a ton more. I mean, I'm sure he will. He's got energy of a Duracell bunny. But this, if this was to be his last film, it's an absolute beauty to go out on. And it really is a culmination of everything he's done so far.
Well, yeah, and he worked so long on it, hadn't he? I mean, they talked about that interview, he talks about how long the process had been and then how they did have to kind of rip it up and start again when DiCaprio chose, perfectly understandably, to go for the other role, the kind of the key role rather than the Jesse Plemons role. But it's all sort of came together and worked out for the best, I think, really. I thought Jesse Plemons was great, but he doesn't have a huge amount to, he's kind of symbolic, really, the role.
Yeah, he turns up in a very large hat, and that is essentially what he plays, isn't it? The lawman in the very large hat. There has been some criticism on the red carpet. I saw that, you know, people who are Osage and have helped on the film are still, you know, not fully endorsing it in as much as they would have preferred to see this film purely from the point of view of the Lily character and the absolute sort of betrayal of her and her people. And they feel that DiCaprio's performance and also the script allows him some sympathy and allows him some audience affiliation, when in fact, really, they think that he should have been offered no sympathy whatsoever. So there is that element to go into it with. And that, again, is interesting. I want to watch it again, knowing what the people who are descendants of these people have said about it, because that's really of interest too. But yeah, it's an amazing film to start a conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of see that, because like in the later stages, there's a lot of focus on DiCaprio and De Niro kind of having these head-to-heads, which, I mean, obviously are riveting to watch, but it feels like the focus is sort of drifting a bit more towards the white characters in those stages, which, yeah, it was, I think, unfortunate, really, given the real kind of core of the story.
Are we recommending it, do we think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a must-see, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you have any interest in the awards season, you need to have seen this one. This is your number one thing you need to have seen, just as you needed to have seen Tar last year to see that Kate Blanchett was going to sweep up. This is the Lily Gladstone train. It starts here. Okay, so if you fancy The Killers of the Flower Moon, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for some creeping dread. It is nearly Halloween, after all. It's this.
When Tamir and I were kids, my mom used to tell us stories. The Ayah said never to sleep with a bad feeling in our hearts, because there's a dark thing that feeds on those feelings.
What is the deal with Tamira? Is she doing all right?
My stomach drops every time she like appears out of thin air like that.
So this is It Lives Inside. This premiered at Sundance earlier this year. Matthew, what lives inside?
The main focus is an Indian-American teenager, Sam, played by Megan Suri, who people might know from the Never Have I Ever series on Netflix. And essentially, like as the title suggests, it's a tale of demonic possession. There's another girl at her school who's carrying around this mysterious jar of dirt, which turns out to be not dirt, but hosting a supernatural force, which, as you might expect, the jail breaks and this this force gets out and starts to wreak havoc, basically pursuing Sam and her friends and family and teachers all around the school and her community and her home. So it's essentially about trying to fight off this demon, trying to work out what it wants and how to exorcise it. So it's your kind of classic possession story, but kind of given a sort of culturally specific angle to it as well. So, I mean, it goes quite a lot into Sam's background, her cultural heritage that plays into it quite a lot. But then essentially it is a monster movie. And so eventually we see glimpses of this monster, and then finally we get the big reveal in the big showdown. So it follows that kind of possession formula that you do see quite a lot in movies, in modern horror movies.
It sort of reminded me of His House, as much as it is a horror and it does follow tropes, but it is also about an immigrant experience and assimilation or not, and legacy and culture, a specific person's experience and how that manifests itself often in mental health. But it's not as good as His House, I'm sorry to say. Mm-hmm. I wanted this to be better. I don't know. I love the fact that it was about, you know, these two girls and, you know, their experience at high school, and particularly through the lens of, you know, an Indian background and how that plays out, and the fact that they'd grown up together and the sort of rituals that were around their sort of family life. But I wanted more of that. And what I got was a lot of quite repeated scares, people continually being a bit spooked by something, being savaged by something, dragged around, bitten, and then pause, and then someone else being spooked, dragged around, bit. And so by the time we got to the sort of actual nub of it, no spoilers, I kind of had already tired of it, I'm afraid to say. How did you feel?
Yeah, same. Yeah. I mean, I like the fact that they use very practical effects for the final reveal of the monster. That was quite refreshing to see. But yeah, by that point, I kind of lost investment in it, because it feels like it sort of plays a bit fast and loose with the rules in terms of a few times you see characters sort of grievously injured or attacked by this monster, and then they just seem to be fine afterwards. They seem to, I mean, it's like one of the Scream movies where someone's repeatedly stabbed over and over and then just springs back to life. And I kind of found that here. So it sort of made the threat a bit harder to take seriously.
Some people died after a bash at some swings, and some people were absolutely fine after a truly terrifying bashing up in a locker. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily stick to its own rules, but then horror films don't always do that. But no. Yeah, I know what you're saying about that. Absolutely. And let's talk about the creature. Unsettling. I thought this was pretty creepy, I have to say.
Yeah, when it's kind of skulking in the shadows, when you do finally see it, when they sort of reveal it bit by bit. I mean, it's kind of, because it's practical, it's got that kind of tangibleness to it, sort of tactile, which you don't always get with CGI. So yeah, but it just feels like it's kind of a waste, really, that it could have been put in service of something a bit more suspenseful. I thought the recent film Smile, which has a similar sort of demon hopping between people, that did it better and have just had better scares, really. I can't say I was ever really scared by this. But yeah, it's a shame, because the dramatic part of it and the kind of discussions of tradition versus assimilation and cultural backgrounds, it's all really interesting and great to see on the screen. But it's just that it's kind of pegged to this very sort of formulaic horror movie.
Yeah. I mean, and also the fact that these two girls are teenagers, their hormones are raging, mm-hmm. you know, they really want to begin dating boys, and all of that feeds into this idea of, you know, how you feel about yourself and how you project that out, and the monster lurks inside you sometimes. All of that sort of psychological thing is touched upon, but not really fully explored. And I think I just wanted more of that, because the one I would compare it to is The Babadook as well. And that did it so masterfully.
Oh, yeah.
The idea of being haunted by something that is your own psychosis and is your own fears and is your own, how you treat yourself even. And that's done so beautifully and so well. And I wanted this to do that, and it really didn't. So, however, having said that, I don't think it's a bad movie. No. I think it's just a little bit of a lost opportunity. So I think if you're wanting something Halloween-y and scary and teethy, a lot of teeth in this, you're going to get a lot of teeth if you fancy that for Halloween. So it's not that I'm going to say I wouldn't recommend it. I think I'd say go see it, but then maybe watch The Babadook or His House after to sort of really, you know, marinate in that sort of idea. They do that really masterfully. You sending people out to see this one, Matthew?
Yeah, I think if you're a horror aficionado, yeah, I think you'll get something out of it. I mean, if you like creature effects, yeah, I'd recommend it. But yeah, I don't think it's not going to break out like Talk to Me or something like that. It'll be a kind of Scream scale blockbuster.
No.
I think it is more for the sort of horror hardcore.
I want to see more from this director. I'm interested to see more from both these actors. Both girls are excellent in this. From that point of view, it's piqued my interest. If it piques your interest, It Lives Inside is in cinemas from Friday. So it's time to get our spy on now, Matthew, with this.
It's terribly difficult to recruit for a secret service. You're looking for somebody who's a bit bad, but at the same time loyal. There's a type, and I fitted perfectly.
In your memoir, you say none of it's true. It's as I imagined it.
When I was in MI6, it wasn't enough for me. So what I did was reinvent the secret world and fill my own people with it.
Okay, so this is The Pigeon Tunnel. It's a documentary about a writer we've seen so much work on screen of. Tell us a little bit about it, Matthew.
Yeah, so this is a portrait of David Cornwell, a.k.a. John le Carré, the author of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And it's from Errol Morris, the kind of the veteran documentary maker, whose most famous work is probably like the Thin Blue Line and the Fog of War. And in the core of it is very much a one-on-one as Errol interrogate David, but it's kind of weaved in with illustrative clips from all the many TV shows and films that have been based on his work, and lots of kind of dramatic reconstructions that make it look like a spy movie. Lots of kind of shadowy hallways and passageways and tilted angles. So it's kind of Errol Morris doing a sort of his own kind of spy docu noir portrait of Mr. Cornwell.
Did you like it?
To a point, yeah. I mean, it focuses. There's a huge amount of focus on his relationship with his father. He's this kind of very
naughty old Ronnie.
Yeah, naughty Ronnie. Yeah, about his kind of his misdemeanors and his parenting skills or lack thereof. And I felt they maybe dwelled a bit too much on that. I kind of wanted to know more about other aspects of his life. I mean, he kind of. One of the sort of crux of the movie is that you can't really know other people fully, and that people's identities shift and they take on these kind of different masks. So it sort of plays into that insofar as he doesn't sort of give a huge amount away about himself. But I'd kind of like to have known more about just things like his writing process, really, and how he felt about all these adaptations of his work. So we don't really get into that. We see lots of clips. Especially from like the Alec Guinness, Tinker Tailor and Smiley's People. So I'd like to have known a bit more about that, how that all came about, how he felt about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very absorbing.
I loved just to hear him talk.
Yeah.
He's one of those people, like if you ever interview Nolan or someone like that, who talks in full sentences, grown-up sentences, and it's beautifully phrased. And the way he can just speak off the top of his head, like he's writing a book, is honestly mesmerizing. So I found just listening to him talk and the way he described things wonderful. And obviously the actual Pigeon Tunnel of the title is quite an interesting sort of aspect. And the fact that he used it as the title for pretty much every book he wrote, but then subsequently changed it to whatever it is at work, because essentially all of his work is about this very formative experience he had as a boy in Monte Carlo at a hotel with his father, and the sort of the cruelty towards pigeons and the sportsmanship and the fact that we are all kind of flapping down a dark corridor into the light, having pot shots taken at us. And it's how we deal with that and what we do. Yeah. And this idea as well that these pigeons, their instinct was to return to where they started. And that this film is a lot about his instinct to return time and time again to that experience with his father and his mother leaving as well, which is such a huge part of his makeup as well. I like that idea as well, that when James Bond came out, this guy was in the Secret Service. And he's like, it's not like that. You know, like, there's James Bond swanning around the world and we're just basically not really knowing what we're doing. Quite a lot of the time cocking it up and under threat of it collapsing completely because we're not actually very good at it. So I loved all that intrigue. And as a Bond fan and someone who does love The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and I love Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, to understand a little bit about what it really was like to be, you know, a spy, the Kim Philby of it all and everything that sort of came from that, I just found really quite fascinating. But I know what you mean. It does feel like he kept himself apart from this and that there were certain things he didn't reveal, and that all of that beautiful melodious chat that he was doing was a sort of smoke and mirrors particular sort of spy thing. So I don't feel you ever really do get to know Cornwell. You are getting to know John le Carré.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, and it does feel like that's the sort of point of why he's doing this as well, that you can't reveal everything about someone, and he's very much not willing to. So you do get these fascinating portraits of other people, like the spy master who he based George Smiley on, and his dad as well. I mean, that's all fascinating, and all this stuff around betrayal as well. I mean, that's such a big topic. They really dig into that and discuss that and the nature of it and how perhaps human beings are kind of inclined towards that. So it's quite a dark vision, really, of human nature.
Yes, it's not going to make you think that mankind are great, but neither is Kibbles of the Flower Moon. If you're a fan of the books or any of the adaptations, it is a very interesting sort of insight into how those worlds were built and how he had so much inspiration. And he was, you know, a prodigious writer. Yeah, and so where that's coming from and what fuels that is really quite interesting. And also, it's on Apple TV Plus, which means, you know, you can have this as a side dish. You don't have to go to the cinema. You can just enjoy this and have it as like almost a DVD extra to a film that is an adaptation of Le Carré. Actually, that's the other thing. There was so much of that in there that I was like, oh, I haven't seen The Spy That Came In From the Cold for ages. Richard Burton in black and white and the whole, you know, East Germany business and the walls and stuff. I want to watch that again. So if you haven't seen anything that he's produced, make you want to see it, and if you have, probably want to return to it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, it's interesting they don't have the Gary Oldman film. I don't know if they get the rights, but
that was odd.
They say anything about that, and that was such a huge hit,
and that's a masterful adaptation. And he's incredible in that. Do seek it out if you watch this and you want to see one. That is an amazing interpretation of that book. So I think we're saying do have a little look at this on Apple TV Plus.
Yeah, it's great to see Errol Morris still making these fascinating portraits as well. I mean, he's absolutely a master of the docu-portrait. So if you're a fan of his work, it's recommended.
Yeah, yeah. I love the way the questions he asks. And I think, gosh, I wish I could ask that question in an interview when I've got 10 minutes with a director or an actor. So, you know, tell me about your mother leaving. I would love to do that. I might just throw that in future, see how we do.
Ask about God.
Ask about God, ask about betrayal and suitcases. There's a suitcase that features in this that just reminded me of Rosebud in Citizen Kane, the sort of fixation on a particular white suitcase. Yeah. It's all really quite fascinating. So if you fancy The Pigeon Tunnel, it is on Apple TV Plus from Friday. Final film now, in case you didn't know, it's half term, and it's this.
We are gonna make boy band history tonight.
Bro, you're making Baby Branch nervous.
I feel like I'm gonna barf and pass out and
pee your pants all at once.
How'd you know?
Give it up for Rosa!
My exquisitely chiseled rock hard abs and I quit.
Branch, we're out of sync. We've gone from boys to men, and now there's only one direction for us to go. The back streets.
Bye. See you later.
Branch?
What? Oh, hey.
Are you all right? You're smiling and crying at the same time. It kind of looks like it's hurting your face.
It does hurt my face.
So, Matthew, this is Trolls Band Together, and you dragged yourself out on a Sunday morning to see this.
I did, When I went to a big party on Saturday night, so I wasn't perhaps feeling in the best mood for an early Sunday morning screening with all the bells and whistles and the dance parties on stage and the giveaways and the sugar. Yeah, this is the third part in the Trolls trilogy. following Trolls and the second one, whatever it's called. I can't even remember it.
Doesn't matter. It's just Trolls. Part deux.
And this one, it's got quite an outlandish premise because you've got Justin Timberlake's character. It turns out he was once in a very successful boy band, which, I mean, how they come up with these ideas?
I know. No idea. Stranger than fiction.
It's just so weird. And the fact that he's never mentioned this before in the two previous movies. So anyway, he was in this band with his four brothers. And the whole kind of crux of the movie is that he wants to get back together with these brothers to reform the band. But one of them has been kidnapped by this evil brother and sister pop duo who are a bit like the brother and sister in Blades of Glory. They kind of reminded me of them.
Yes.
Yeah, the evil ice skaters. Once again, it's another sort of long journey all around the houses. Lots of pop songs from past and present. Anna Kendrick's character, Poppy, she's in the mix as well. And there's a kind of family reveal. There's lots of family reveals in this. And at one point, a character jokes about all the family reveals, saying, you know, trying to make light of it, even though it is a bit of a hackneyed device. But it is very much a Trolls movie. So incredibly bright colours, lots of bouncy montages, lots of singing, different creatures, different variants of trolls with multicoloured rainbow hair.
And the NSYNC lads are in it.
They are, yeah. They've got their first new song in 20 years, which I won't spoil it, but may or may not be worth waiting for. I can't remember it already. there's certainly lots of other famous pop song and lots of boy band references, which is interesting. I saw it with my son, and he had to explain the modern boy band references to me, and I explained the sort of who New Edition and New Kids on the Block were to him. So it was very much a kind of parent child collaboration watching this movie.
So which of you enjoyed it more?
Probably me, to be honest, weirdly. Yeah, I really didn't like the second one. I thought the first one was okay, but the second Trolls. And I'm just thinking of that reminds me of the pandemic, because it was the first big movie to go straight to streaming. So kind of brings back those memories. But yeah, I thought that was fairly poor. But yeah, I thought this was okay. I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, the vocal performances, especially Anna Kendrick, I mean, you kind of forgive her for being a bit jaded three movies in, but she brings so much enthusiasm and energy to this role. You can't help but get swept up in it. And
I think I could help and get swept.
You probably could, yeah.
Because I really do not want to see this.
No.
I feel really like this is a film that the only grown-ups that are going to be there are people who are having to entertain children.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to this because they're a cinephile who's a completist, are they?
No, probably not. No, I think it is adults who've got children in tow, but they do kind of cater to the adults. I mean, there's lots of 80s and 90s songs, like Eurythmics kind of pop up quite a lot. And all these kind of references, there's kind of a high nostalgia factor to it. So, yeah, depending on your expectations, mine were absolutely rock bottom. I have to say I did enjoy it.
Even with a hangover,
yeah. Timberlake's character is fun. Amy Schumer's in the mix this time as well. Adds to the fun. I've seen far, far worse, I have to say.
Okay, where would you place this on a scale between one being appalling and five being, you know, like a Pixar classic?
I think sort of a low three. I think, yeah, I think in terms of our star ratings.
Perfectly respectable, isn't it?
Yeah.
You say that there's loads of revelations for family things. Mm. Do we feel like this is the big bang? This is the last one out the gate? Or is there of course not.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there'll be more depending on how successful this is. I'm sure they'll keep going with it. Yeah, it doesn't feel like it kind of reaches the end of the road in any sense. So, I mean, it's up to you. It's up to you, punters. If you want to end this now, don't go and see it. But if you're perpetuating this,
it's your own fault if you get a fourth. And if you go and see it, you're going to get a fourth. That's what you're saying, basically. Okay, so decent half-term rainy day action. Then you can while away a couple of hours, listen to some songs, and everyone's perfectly entertained.
Yeah, and it's quite a novelty as well to see with all the kind of corporate origin stories we've had this year. It's actually a film that is about the toys themselves. It's not going. I was kind of half expecting it, and you know, the creator of the Trolls to suddenly pop up and explain how they kind of went through the process of making them. You know, a la the Beanie Bubble or something like that. So
or BlackBerry or Air. Yeah. We're not trying to do that with this. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of very bright, very poppy, very yeah, loud and cheery fun, then Trolls Band Together might be for you and a kid that you're trailing around. And it's in cinemas from Friday. So that's it this week, Matthew. What would be your film of the week?
Well, it's pretty easy, isn't it? Killers of the Flower Moon. But I did enjoy The Pigeon Tunnel and Trolls.
Oh, that's not the order I thought you'd go in. it's, you know, far and away Killers of the Flower Moon for me. I could listen to that man's talk about his books in The Pigeon Tunnel. I might even put it on tonight as I'm falling asleep. His voice is delightful. So from that level, I really like that one. We should also say that we have a new issue out now. Who's on the cover?
Very special issue. It's a big Ridley Scott celebration. So we've got insight into his new film, Napoleon, but also into his entire filmography. I mean, he's incredible. All those iconic movies, his Alien, Blade Runner, Gladiator, Thelma and Louise. He talks about all of them. And we've got some very special guests as well to talk about Ridley and what his work means to them. Christopher Nolan, Denis Villeneuve, Guillermo del Toro. So, yeah, it's a pretty epic issue.
Fittingly epic for a man who makes epic films. And also, I think we're going to try and adopt his way of speaking to people that he thinks are idiots, who he calls you dope. Come on, you dope. I think we should bring that back. We're going to try and do that in the office. If Ridley doesn't float your boat, then maybe 100 greatest horror films of the 21st century might do it. We have counted down, and it's not all the usual suspects. This is all of the new breed. We had many fisticuffs and full-on car park fights over this. It was like Anchorman, but we have whittled it down to 100, and we've chosen our number one, so do buy it for that. A reminder as well that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and it will come straight to you. Okay, before we go then, Matthew, we do have time for a listener's question, and this is, who's the best singer turned movie star? I guess this might be, you know, Madonna's currently on tour. She's doing her greatest hits. She's done a bit of movie. And I'm not a Madonna is a crap actor. I enjoy a bit of Desperately Seeking Susan. And I think she is absolutely perfectly tonally fine in Dick Tracy. Your thoughts?
There's only one answer for me, even though he was not the best actor in the world. But Prince, very much
enjoyed. I knew you were going there. Prince's
filmography. He only made four films, but he kind of ticked a lot of boxes. He had a big box office success. He had a cult film, had an absolutely disastrous flop, and then he had one that had loads of critical raves. So even though he it was fairly short tenure, he did kind of go across the whole spectrum, really.
And the lady I saw on stage last night was in one of his films, Kristin Scott Thomas.
Her debut. Yes. Under the Cherry Moon.
Exactly, which is a cracking tune. I love that one. I do love Purple Rain. I think it's a great film. Very lot of frilly shirt costuming that I'm very much partial to. I'd have to go as well, you know, similarly. You know, I think Elvis was not a bad actor. I know everyone say he's rubbish in all of his like travelogue sort of musicals, but if you look at what he did at the start of his career in King Creole, there was potential there. He could have possibly made it. I wish he'd done A Star Is Born instead of Kris Kristofferson. I would have loved to have seen what he'd have done with that. But my other person that I think is, you know, amazing in every way is Zendaya. You know, she was this Disney kid. She's been a little pop star. And now she is this absolute force of nature. Great actress. Amazing sort of fashion vanguard. A pioneer. She turns up on carpets in outfits that you're just like, what? How is she carrying that off? She's an executive producer. She's, you know, producing films like the film with Luca Guadagnino that got stalled to next year. She seems also just to be a girl that's got her head screwed on and is a nice person. Yeah. So Euphoria, you know, the whole shebang. I think she's an incredible singer turned movie star. And I can't wait to see what she does in Dune. Bring back Dune. Oh, why do we have to wait for Dune 2? I want to see what Zendaya is doing in part 2. Yeah. Okay, so on that note, I think we'll say goodbye and we'll see what singer turned movie star we lead out with as a song. But for now, let's say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.